This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
It's nice to see all of you, especially my pilgrim friends. I have a few here. Hi, Heather. Many of you I don't know. So I meditate in the Vipassana tradition, and I'm just a local Dharma teacher in Flagstaff, Arizona. I'm also a cultural anthropologist and an author of books about different cultural worlds that range from a South Pacific village where I lived for 3 years to a college freshman dorm where I lived for a year, to my most recent book that is on homelessness. So I give book talks and I give Dharma talks, but this is actually the first time that I'm attempting to give a talk about one of my books in the context of the Dharma. And I'm doing this because Shaila suggested it, but also because my life off of the cushion has been increasingly affected, as I'm sure it has for many of you. It's been increasingly affected by my practice and vice versa. So this talk is really about the not always so conscious process for me of integrating life and practice. And I'm going to share a few images. For part of the talk, and I'm going to start that right now. So can everybody see that? Okay, our title today, When We Meet Suffering, Buddhist Insights from Encounters with Homelessness. So I want you to come back with me to 2008. And I was going to the dog park in Flagstaff with my dogs as I did every morning. And on this November morning, around 7 a.m., the sun was just coming up. As I opened the gate to the chain link fence around this little dog park, I could see a figure seated at the picnic table within its confines. I strained my eyes to see more clearly, and I made out something close to what you're looking at now, a slumped figure, a beard. He had on an army jacket and a baseball hat. And it was maybe a little bit darker than that. And I saw him there in the distance. He was just sitting there, keeping his gaze averted. And I had a sense of fear. It was still kind of dark. There was no one else around. The guy didn't look right. Maybe I shouldn't go in. But then I saw there was a dog there too. And I thought, maybe it's okay. So I walked through the gate very carefully, latched the gate, but I stood close by to the entrance, watching this guy and thinking, if he moves toward me, I'm out of here. He never turned to acknowledge me. We never said anything. A few minutes later, I took my dogs and I left, unsure when I related the story to a friend whether I had just been lucky. So I think this is what started things for me. I think had I not been a practicing meditator, the next steps might not have happened. Mindful of my fear and the total sense of contraction I had felt, I took this incident and ultimately this man into my practice. Within the boundaries of my discernment, I looked for him again and then again, going back to the same park. And I began to practice metta. It brought home for me the first Buddhist teaching on metta, which had always confused me. That Buddha's first teaching of the practice of metta happens in the context not of hate, but of fear. You might know the story, right? I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. It goes something like this. There's 500 monks go to a seemingly very genial forest spot for their three-month rainy season retreat. And it's near a village of strong supporters who are offering to build huts and provide arms. It seems perfect. And so the monks moved in and began practicing meditation. But then the forest devas, the spirits that who live there, come to realize that the monks are not just passing through, but they're moving in. And they're put out by the intrusion into their home. And so they begin to create frightening sounds and sights and emit some very distasteful odors, hoping to drive the monks away. And it works. The monks become so terrified that they can't concentrate or meditate. Some monks develop fever and pain and dizziness and other stress symptoms, and they leave. They return to the Buddha to find out where next they should go. And to this, their dismay, he instructs them. He instructs them to stay. My beloved monks, he says, go back to exactly the same forest and practice your meditation there. No, no, they say, we can't meditate there. It's too hostile, too threatening. And the Buddha replies, and I'll take it from the text, dear monks, because you went there to practice meditation without a weapon of protection, you have encouraged many distractions and difficulties. This time, however, I will give you a true weapon of protection. It is said that this is the point at which Buddha offers them the metta or loving kindness meditation, teaching and practice. So what happens? They go back to the forest for a while, continuing to experience feelings of fear and anxiety, while at the same time, they are diligently and virtuously practicing metta. In a little while, there were no more fearful sights or sounds. And whereas the devas had previously been hostile to the monks, their anger and resentment begins to dissipate when they begin to feel the monks' metta. And instead, feelings of respect, welcome, and even reverence begin to be the devas' experience, along with the sense of being connected like with family. And the inclination arises in the devas to provide an environment of safety, to protect the monks from particular dangers that might be lurking in the forest so they could practice meditation peacefully. So that's the story. And the great surprise for me is that it worked almost exactly the same way in my own life. If I fast forward to 2020, I can tell you that what was a source of fear became a source of friendship, ultimately of collaboration and of joy. The fellow there is named Ross. That was the guy in the dog park. He even saved me one day, years ago, when I got embroiled in the middle of a dog fight and everyone else ran the other way. It struck me as so similar to the monks in the forest and the forest spirits. Metta really does work like that. It dissipates our boundaries as it protects us and increases our ease and our joy. And the difficulty, I think, in initially seeing the wisdom in this, how it could be that feelings of goodwill toward others could be protective of my happiness, is, with my anthropologist hat, in part cultural. So take a look at this. This image is used to study cross-cultural views of happiness. Okay. How happy is the center guy? Okay. On a scale of 1 to 10. Mark it down in your mind. Okay. Rate him. How happy is the center guy? 1 to 10. And now I want you to look at the second image. And now rate the center guy in the bottom picture on a scale of 1 to 10. How happy is the center guy in that picture? Okay. You have that in your mind? So I want you to consider your own ratings. How do your two ratings compare? It doesn't really matter what number you rated the center guy. It matters how similar were your ratings in the two pictures. And can you see those two pictures now? I don't know what you have on. Can you see them both? Thank you.
Yes, I can.
Okay, thanks. Okay. So here's how it worked culturally. Americans viewing this two pictures tend to rate the center guy the same in both pictures. And why is that? Well, his face looks exactly the same, right? But for South Koreans and Chinese who looked at the same pictures, they had a very consistent choice of rating the center guy less happy in picture A and more happy in picture B. And why is that? Okay. Because notice the people around him are less happy. And if you didn't even notice that, I would say join the American club. But even Americans who do notice that don't think it should matter what the other people are doing. And that is because the individualism in our country is such a defining feature of our worldview that our happiness and well-being is often understood as something internal, independent of others. And interestingly, Americans who rated the center guy differently in the two pictures tend to rate A higher. He's happier in A. Why is the guy happier in A? Because he's uniquely happy. Happy when even the people around him are not happy. That's kind of the American take on that. The proclivity for individualism, these bounded selves and bounded worlds, is also what can keep us, as illustrated in that first picture, a little oblivious to the suffering of others. Metta helps to thin those walls around the self that shield us from others and what they're going through. I found that as my own boundaries softened, What happened is that I became more attentive and concerned about Ross. Where is he getting his hot food on these cold nights? Was he really sleeping outside or in his car? How did he get a shower or medical care or money? I started asking more. He started talking more. I was to learn that he had lived homeless for many years, living mostly in the forest. He worked day labor jobs because he was a felon who had served 7 years in federal prison for burglary. And he had trouble getting regular work because of the felony conviction. I became progressively drawn into the life that he and eventually others I met were living. The lives that I saw moved me. And in the classic Buddhist sense, when metta meets suffering, there is compassion and an impulse to act. And I found myself making decisions that went beyond my friendship with Ross. Maybe it's even more accurate to say that I started allowing the world to act on me differently. In the beginning, it was just carrying little bags in my car with snacks and shampoo and socks that I could hand out to homeless people that I saw. But then when the county jail called to see if by any chance I would be interested in coming there to offer meditation classes free to inmates, as I did in the university community, I said yes. And I also began volunteering at the local homeless shelter, serving food and assigning beds and finding the right boots or gloves or from the donated stock for someone, handing out soap and toothpaste. I began to see not only the suffering there, but also the ways that my own misperceptions or disinterest unwittingly contributed to the suffering. Ross never spoke to me that day in the park, I found out, right? Even though he came to the park seeking human company because he sensed my fear and he didn't want to scare me into calling the police by initiating contact with me. 5 years after Ross and I met, after I had begun to learn more about homeless people and things like, you'd see if you read the book, things like pawn shops and payday loans and parole officers. After we sat together in food banks and housing offices and panhandling corners, I asked Ross the question, "Do you want to write a book together?" And his response at the time was, "You're crazier than I am." But we ended up writing the book together anyhow, and including a third author, one of my ex-students who had worked with homeless day laborers. The result for me of all of this, and it's something that I can say to meditators and sometimes not as clearly or as easily to other people who read the book, it was getting to see what was at the other side of my contraction and my fear. And this is how I described it in our book. Like others who cross cultures or the boundaries of our upbringing, we find in ourselves not only a greater responsiveness to the human condition, but also the delight of living in a world less alien, less hostile, less unloving than it felt before. And I think that's really what it offered me. And I'm going to stop sharing for a minute, screen sharing. and just talk with a few more comments without the PowerPoint. Hello again, everybody. I think it's a great spiritual challenge, really, to cross the boundaries of our upbringings and, or even ultimately, the boundary of our separate selves, you know? It's what I take from the story of Siddhartha, the life of the Buddha, when despite his comforts of life as the son of a wealthy oligarch, he decides to leave the palace walls. But it's beyond the protective safety of the walls where he first encounters real suffering, but it's also where he finds enlightenment. The metaphor, if we consider it beyond the historical, the story of Siddhartha, can become a spiritual question. Are we ready to leave the palace? And in our culture, of course, the challenge looks a little differently, leaving the palace, to leave the palace of our social circle, our realm of experience, our safety zone, our belief system. But it still remains a rich spiritual question. Where are the areas in our lives where we might be thinking about leaving the palace? What would that look like for you? In a recent article in Lion's Roar, that was entitled How to Become a Bodhisattva. Okay. The psychologist and teacher Pilar Jennings, you might have seen the article, talks about where he thinks people in his own psychology practice stumble in their intention to do this, to be bodhisattvas. Where do they stumble? And his assessment simply is this. They typically withdraw from suffering as self-protection. I can feel like that. The more I open my heart to suffering, the more difficult my life becomes. There are days this last year that we all just lived when it felt like a threat to my happiness to watch the news or find out about one more dying species, or see the latest predictions on global warming. It's not that I don't get this, but I do think our practice points us someplace else, that it's outside of our bubble of self-contraction that peace and joy really reside. And I want to be clear, it doesn't mean that to immerse ourselves in every problem our world faces. I love the Thomas Merton quote, which is, to allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone in everything, is to succumb to the violence of our times. I do really believe that. So keeping that in mind though, what specific issue, set of people or circumstances can we open to? What has been calling us? And in whatever way you will decide to step out of the palace, you begin a journey that expands your practice. For me, the challenge has been not to be overwhelmed with the suffering that I witness and not to be too discouraged by the piddling results of my actions to relieve that suffering, because sometimes they're piddling. My own involvement with homelessness and with the overlapping jail population has led me more deeply into a practice of equanimity, How can I be with all of this with some level of balance and acceptance that keeps me able to be there and able to be useful? Opening to homelessness is what has encouraged more balance and acceptance in my own life and practice, while my practice in both loving kindness and in equanimity has better allowed me to be able to take some action to relieve suffering in the world. It's a good lesson in Thich Nhat Hanh's idea of interbeing. So I end by inviting you to invite the world into your practice and to find the ways in return to offer the world the great merits of your practice, because there are great merits to your practice that you have to offer. So thank you for your attention. I love, because I'm a professor, I love when it's exactly a half hour, you know, it's exactly what it's supposed to be. So let's sit together, okay? And the way that this evening will work, it's kind of the reverse of sometimes the way they do this. We're going to sit together for about 30 minutes or so, 35 minutes. And then I will open it up for a discussion or a Q&A or whoever wants to stay to discuss these topics. Okay. And bringing to mind yourself. Okay. Thinking of yourself, maybe as a child, maybe as a younger version of yourself. Sometimes that's easier for Americans to do. Can you envision your own face and feel a sense of tenderness or warmth for that face? Wishing yourself well. May I be happy and peaceful. May I be safe, protected from inner and outer harm. May I be healthy in body and in mind. May I live with a sense of ease. And notice, if you would, if a little warmth has happened in the area around your sternum. And feel it build as you bring to mind a good friend or a benefactor or a loved one, even a pet. Envision them, seeing the look on their face, seeing them smiling maybe at you, feeling the warmth in yourself. As they smile, that maybe wants to radiate outward to them. And to that friend, wish them well. May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be protected. May you be healthy. May you live with a sense of ease. And envision them hearing your words, hearing your good wishes, and smiling back at you, and feel what that feels like in yourself. Can you feel a sense of warmth there? And is there enough warmth that you feel right now that you can radiate it out further, that you can offer it further? First, maybe to all the folks tonight on Zoom with us. Some of these people are your friends. Some of them are strangers. Can you extend those good wishes to them? Happy. Safe. Healthy. At ease. And as you feel that going out and also being given to you by all these people, can you radiate it further, as far as you can, as far as you choose, to all those meditating tonight around the world, or to all beings everywhere? Happy. May you be safe and protected. May you be healthy. May you live with a sense of ease. And now with the same openness of heart and goodwill that you're feeling, you can turn your attention now to the feeling of the body breathing. Letting the body breathe as it will. And feeling a sense of kindness maybe to whatever the breath is like. Whatever this moment has to offer.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.